And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Ussery, and I'm pleased to welcome Julie Bunton to the program today. Julie is the director of the writing programs at Catapult, and her work has appeared in The Atlantic, Cosmopolitan, and Slate, among others. Today, we'll be discussing her debut novel, Marlena. It's the story of a friendship between two teenage girls in rural Michigan and the decades-long effects that it has on one of them. Julie, you start off Marlena with one of the strongest opening lines I've read in quite some time. Tell me what you can't forget, and I'll tell you what you are.
Yeah. I'm glad you felt it was a good opening to the book. I did something a little bit odd in the writing of this book, which is that I basically rewrote it after it sold. And when I did that, I cut a lot of stuff out of the book and really changed kind of the structure and the story and removed a character and all sorts of things. But one of the things that always was there was that first sentence. The first sentence and the last sentence were kind of the two points around which everything revolved for me. And yeah, I mean, I think I wanted to establish right away that this is a book about memory more than anything else. It's about the thing that kind of haunts you or won't let you go for Kat.
Normally, I'll turn the tables on an author and ask them what they can't forget. Mm-hmm. But since you've given it as a prescriptive, I'll tell you what I can't forget, and you can tell me what I am. Anything. Memory like a steel trap.
Really?
Yeah, I just remember so many things. I have a mind for trivia, and it's just ridiculous that, you know, I know who hit the most triples in Major League Baseball history. His name was Hack Wilson, and just all this little errata, every bit of my life is there.
That's just so interesting. Is there anything that, like, haunts you specifically, or, like, kind of, even if it's like a fact or something, like any
something
story
that
or
haunts me?
Yeah, or just of all the things that you remember, something that, like, kind of is always there.
Nothing seems persistent, but one thing that is consistently comes back is a dream I had as a child about my family going to an old creepy castle on a dark and stormy night.
Whoa.
And then I tripped at the award ceremony in seventh grade going up to receive an award for English class.
That's
and
interesting.
For some reason, that trip plays back very frequently in my mind.
That's really interesting. I mean, I am no psychologist, but if in kind of like the thinking that I was sort of applying to my narrator's life and telling the story of this thing that she can't let go of, this thing that's made her who she is. I mean, if you think about your trip, you're tripping as this thing that like carries you forward in your life or haunts you. It's interesting. Maybe you're worried about being embarrassed. Or, you know,
always.
Yeah.
I aspire to be middle class, and isn't embarrassment the biggest fear of the middle class?
Yeah, I think that's true.
The story is told in two different time periods. We have a contemporary strain of action, and then we have flashbacks to about 20 years prior. Mm-hmm. In that telling, our narrator is a first-person narrator named Kat. Are her telling of her time back in Michigan 20 years ago, are those her memories from now that she's recollecting back on, or are they as they happened in Michigan?
I think of the whole book as cast through the filter of memory. So one thing I wasn't interested in doing when I was writing this book, I was very interested in writing about teenage girls and the vulnerability of that time and adolescence and how dangerous it can be and how reckless it can be and how your choices when you're so young and so incapable of making smart choices in so many ways, you should be protected from them, but you're not as a teenager. You have kind of like the full culpability for what you do, and it can be very dangerous. So I wanted to write about all those things, but I didn't want to write from the perspective of a teenage girl without the sort of psychic matter of existing beyond that time. I didn't want to be limited to a teenage girl's emotional range to her. I wanted to access it in memory. I wanted to have Kat have these moments where she could be so childish and so judgmental, of especially like her mother, the way that teenage girls so often are, and so blindingly naive. But I really wanted that to be kind of cast looking back, really, because I wanted to be able to explore that memory from a lot of different places, from her as in her 20s, in her early 30s at the time. So that was important to me in writing the book, that I had these two time periods, but that it was always Kat's memory, and even her memory of a memory in some ways.
The epigraph for the book comes from Ursula K. Le Guin's The Left Hand of Darkness, which is one of my favorite books.
That book.
And it's, I'll make my report as if I told a story, for I was taught as a child in my homeworld that truth is a matter of the imagination.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got perhaps somewhat unreliable.
I think one of Kat's great frustrations in the story, in the act of telling the story is, I mean, have you ever had the experience, I'm sure you have, especially if you remember everything, of like wanting to tell someone a story of a thing you remember, but knowing you're not getting it right because you can't, because you are forgetting something or you remember something later, or you weren't objective in this specific way. I mean, that question of how impossible it is to remember something as it was is really kind of what is driving her to tell this and to keep digging and keep trying to get to the truth. And for me, the epigraph spoke to that in a way. I mean, I think epigraphs are weirdly private. At least it feels private to me. Like, I almost can't explain why, of all the things I've read, that is the thing that speaks the most to this book. Like, that book couldn't be more different from my book in a lot of ways. But it does, for me, somehow. It sort of addresses this idea of how we can get to what is true using our memories, using a combination of memory and imagination, how a narrator can never quite, is always sort of limited by being themselves.
The thing I remember most from the book was the concept of how can you know what to eat and trust it if it won't poison you?
Yeah.
And it's that you will die unless you do eat it.
Yeah.
And that's how you learn to eat new things.
That book is so good. I think about that book all the time.
It's been 20-something years since
I've read it. You should reread it.
Like, I have time
yeah.
to reread everything.
Looking around this place full of books, you definitely don't.
Now, the book is divided into two major parts, and at the end of part one, there's a section called Omissions, mm-hmm. in which a lot of important information is given to us that would have made a lot of sense mm-hmm. of the memories that came before. In Kat's putting that omissions section there, was she trying to mislead us, or had she just forgotten to give it at that point?
I think she's wants to acknowledge some of the things that I've mentioned before, that she can't be trusted, that even what she's trying to do, telling someone else's story in this way, it's impossible. So I think, you know, Marlene is an addict, and Kat is in her own way an addict as well. She's an alcoholic, which makes her unreliable in the narrative present in ways that are maybe a little bit different than in her memories. But in that omission section, one thing that's hard about addicts, not to get too personal, is knowing one or knowing someone who's sort of struggled with that, is wondering what you could have done as a bystander or as a friend or as a sibling or daughter or parent, whatever. Wondering, was I an enabler? Like, how did I influence what happened to this person? Could I have gotten involved in a different way? What's my responsibility to this? All very selfish things, and in a lot of ways, like, you can't do anything. But I think if you're close to someone who's struggling with that, you ask those questions. So the omission section, in a way, is Kat acknowledging that she didn't understand the extent of how bad things were for her friend, and also that she doesn't want to go there in her mind, because acknowledging that she could have put those clues together and changed, perhaps been a little bit more awake to it, it might have been different. So that's how I see that chapter functioning, those omissions. She says, I have to share this because I'm telling the truth now, but I left them out before because it was too painful. I wanted it to be less dark. I wanted it to be better, safer. I wanted to have a memory of us just being like regular girls. But that's not that story. So she has to push herself to go there. The same way she has to push herself to be honest about her drinking in the narrative present.
She says early on, there's no such thing as an innocent bystander. Mm-hmm. And she kind of hints at the observer effect mm-hmm. in science. And then later on in the book, she's talking about her life in New York as an adult and how she intensely scrutinizes women for possible friendships mm-hmm. and everything she notices about their behavior mm-hmm. while they're talking and getting to know each other. And I was wondering what effect she has as the observer on those potential new friendships.
Oh, that's interesting. I almost think of that as like, it's Kat thinking about, I mean, in the act of telling, like, this isn't a mystery. The book isn't a mystery. So there's not really spoilers in that sense. But like, the book is ultimately aware of its existence as a book. It's in a lot of ways, it's a book about the act of writing a book or the act of telling a story. So I don't think of Kat as an observer in that sense in those real moments, but I think of it more as in reflecting on her adult friendships and how different the texture of those friendships are, the different intensity, the way that they unfold, how they never kind of have the same sort of passion of an adolescent friendship. She's looking at it with like an extra microscope kind of in the act of telling, though in the moment, I'm not sure that she's... If she was telling that as it was happening, I'm not sure she would be like as obsessive of an observer, if that makes sense. But I do think that, you know, again, a lot of the themes in the book, when you're talking about addiction and all these things, there is no such thing as an innocent bystander. Like I believe that as an author and having written this specific story, and I believe that as like a person in the world. And I think that's something that Kat is grappling with too. Like, I was there. How did my being there change this story?
And so the book does open with a memory, mm-hmm. and it's her thinking of her friend Marlena, mm-hmm. who she knew in high school back in Michigan about mm-hmm. 20 years prior. What are her first memories in, mm-hmm. in the book?
It opens with this scene with the girls in the car. Marlena's driving, and she's driving very fast. Kat reflects that she was probably high, though in the moment, as a teenager, she didn't quite understand that, I think. But I wanted to start with a feeling of things being out of control or on the edge of something, or that sense of danger. But also, I mean, one thing that's been interesting in hearing people's responses to this book is they're like, oh, it's so sad. Like, I just wanted to tell them to, like, stop doing that bad, stupid stuff, which I get. I wanted to tell them that, too, as I wrote some of that bad, stupid stuff. But I wanted to capture what it's like as a teenager to be attracted to that recklessness or that danger and know it's bad, be frightened, and like it also, which is seemed to me to be the right place to start that memory for those girls.
Now, prior to this, Kat and her family had lived in Pontiac, Michigan. Mm-hmm. They had moved up north to Silver Lake after her parents' marriage ended. And she was a scholarship student at mm-hmm. a good private high school. Do you think she was just more likely to mimic whichever group she was in?
Yes.
It was just pure accident that she followed along with Marlena?
I do, kind of. Yeah, I think that's something that I thought about a lot. Like, we've all heard these stories before. Like, new girl gets caught up in the web of an intoxicating friend. Those kinds of ideas about girlhood and friendship they have become kind of like literary tropes. But one reason I wanted to explore them in this context is because I wanted to explore them with the awareness that those tropes inform how girls actually behave in the world. And those are part of our cultural signaling. So girls actually act those things out. And I think that Kat, in that moment, stepped into this role of like, I will be the sidekick to this friend. And she thinks about that a little bit in the book. She thinks about, what if she had just lived in a different house? Like, what if they hadn't been neighbors at all? And I wanted both girls to go into the story with each other with blank slates, kind of, because I wanted to talk about how friendship is kind of an act of mutual storytelling. Like, it's a collaborative act. It's creative. And these girls are deciding who they want to be as girls who will be women soon, but also who they want to be because of each other, who they want to be together. So I wanted them to kind of have that background that could be informed by the other one, and they needed to meet in order for that to happen. They couldn't be like best friends from childhood, you know?
Marlena has a bit more agency. She kind of sets the tone of where they're going. And I'm just wondering, what does that say about Kat as a person, that she is one more to follow other people's leads?
Yeah, I think that Kat, she's younger too. I mean, she's 15, Marlena's 17. I think of Kat as very confused. I mean, in some ways, I think of this story, one reason she's revisiting this story as an alcoholic looking back at this time is she's thinking, like, why haven't I ever been, like, who am I? Like, am I the person who just kind of bends to the will of the strongest thing around me? Why couldn't I have been stronger or sit up for myself more or less passive even? And she finds a little bit of that agency through Marlena's example, I think. And that's something I wanted to play with too. Like, Marlena's the addict, but Marlena, in a lot of ways, is a stronger character. She's a driver. She knows what she wants. I mean, her moral radar is also, it's confused by the fact that she's an addict, so she's driven by those impulses primarily, but at the same time she has a sense of like what she thinks is right and what she thinks is wrong, whereas Kat's just like confused. Like, she'll do anything because she's sort of desperate for connection, I think. And that's something that I do believe is very common in adolescent experience, especially for girls, and something I wanted to talk about, the susceptibility of peer pressure, how strong those impulses can be, and are they dangerous, and how do you reconcile with them when you grow up and you think, like, I never would have done that, but you did.
I mean, she also followed her parents' lead because her mother drank too much, so she began drinking too much, and prior to the end of their marriage, her father had lost his mm-hmm. job. Continue to pretend to go to work so he could spend time with the woman he was sleeping with. And so when she moves up to Silver Lake, she pretends to go to school and just, you know, plays hooky all the time.
Yeah. It's interesting to write about teenage girls and who are making a lot of mistakes because, you know, I love my characters even if they're stupid sometimes. And one thing that was like funny or interesting about writing Kat in those moments is that she's full of that 15-year-old sort of sense of hubris at the same time where she's like, I am nothing like my parents. Everything they do is stupid and wrong, which is just pretty basic. But at the same time, she can't see then in the moment that she's basically enacting their same behaviors. She thinks she's different somehow. But when she looks back, and this is one of the reasons I wanted to have the ability to reflect from a later stage in life, she sees, like, actually, I was just acting out by mimicking like the same behavior that I was being shown.
And finally, later in the book, she does say, our parents are with us always. No surgery can cut them
yeah.
out.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's an awareness she has to come to, too, I think.
In the lines of hubris, she's also accused of being quite a snob by mm-hmm. both her friends and family. And she cops to it pretty
mm-hmm.
readily.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do think she's kind of a snob. I mean, she has been a little bit tainted by her experience at this fancy school and then the kind of abrupt smack of being removed from it and dropped into this new world where she feels simultaneously hungry to fit in and also this little sense of being like better than it, I think, which is something that Marlena smells in her and uses against her, I think, or it's part of their power dynamic that, you know, Marlena's cooler, she's stronger, she's prettier, but Kat has more opportunity. She's maybe, I don't even think of her as smarter, but she's more educated. She's read more. She has more kind of awareness of the larger world. And so the two girls are kind of circling each other in all of these ways. Like, I have this, you have this.
Since Kat is somewhat impressionable, which books do you think made the most impact on her life during that time period?
Oh, that's such a fun question. You know, I very unconsciously kind of like wound the books. She makes reference to a lot of books. Left Hand of Darkness is one, I think. She loves Stephen King, and I think that when she's reading it, when she gets to Silver Lake for the first time, and it's sort of coloring her feeling of this being like a creepy place or a bad place, I did want some of those books to be like touchstones in that way. Like when she's later in her life, when she's in college, she's reading about damaged women, like Anna Karenina, women who, damaged women is kind of a weird way of putting it, but women who, tragic women or women who suffer, and she's thinking of Marlena and thinking about what that story is. And how her story reflects that or doesn't. So I think kind of all of those, it sort of depends on where she is in the book.
The setting in northern Michigan does seem kind of reminiscent of settings in Maine for
yeah.
Stephen King, and where you have kind of this depressed, dying mill towns mm-hmm, and stuff like
mm-hmm.
that.
Yeah, I'm a huge Stephen King fan, honestly. So that's something Kat and I share. But yeah, he knows how to write small towns. And I don't know, there's just something about Stephen King. I think there's actually something about reading at that age that's different than reading at any other time. When you're a teenager, you read so immersively, things kind of become your whole world. I don't know if it's just because adults are more distracted or what it is, but I find that I don't read. I still read a lot and love to read, but it's not the same, like, total disappear from the universe, completely absorbed in the world of the book thing. So I think Kat's still in that stage where books have that power to be totally transporting.
And could you tell us a little bit about the difference between downstate, the metropolitan area, and the feelings that people in northern Michigan have?
Yeah, downstate? Sure. I'm from the Petoskey area, which the book is set in northern Michigan, sort of in a Petoskey-ish area, but it's fictionalized. I always want to be really clear about that.
I was a little confused about the geography with the mitten, because at one point someone had mentioned the thumb,
yep.
but then they had mentioned the Mackinac
yeah,
Bridge.
Yeah, the thumb area would be when she lived in Pontiac, there
okay.
down here. And then up north is, it's funny, we're on the radio so no one can see this, but I've got my hand like in the air to point it out.
Your left hand.
Yeah.
The thumb on the
yeah,
radio.
So up north is just kind of on the lake shore, up going up towards the UP, but not quite the UP. And, you know, I haven't spent a ton of time in lower Michigan, but it's more developed, basic. You can drive from city to city. There's stuff everywhere. There are big freeways and all that. But in Michigan, where I grew up, in the Petoskey area and north of Traverse City, basically you like, it's pretty remote in a lot of ways. It's also very charming and really popular tourist area, especially in the beaches on the summer. But you drive from town to town. Sometimes you drive 15, 20 minutes through the woods. You don't see that much. And then you get to another town. It's different. My hometown was 5,500 people. I think that's still true. It gets about twice that size in the summer because of all the summer houses. But half the year, they're just a bunch of houses that are empty for people who only come up in June, July, and August. So it's just, it's a different world. Whereas downstate, it's just more people, I think.
There's another difficulty Kat is dealing with, in that her mother is very attractive.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's few curses a teenage girl can have worse than an attractive mother.
Yeah, poor Kat in that way. She's surrounded by, I mean, you know, I think of her as, teenagers are so, can also be so self-hating, teenage girls, I think. And I hope that readers sense that Kat maybe is being harder on herself than she realizes. She hates her body. She's a 15-year-old girl. She's like, I'm so awkward and all these women around me are beautiful. And her mom is this elegant woman. I think when you're so self-conscious about how you look and how your body's changing and how you feel and how you're seen in the world and whether or not boys will ever like you or anyone will ever like you and you don't even understand your own sexuality and you're just confused, I think like having a mom who's attractive is just a reminder every day that you're not kind of in possession of your own idea of how the world is seeing you. So, yeah, I think she definitely feels like that's something that makes her extra vulnerable or something.
And with Marlena being so attractive mm-hmm. to so many people, she has blonde hair like her mother does, mm-hmm. so they would seem to be more of a mother-daughter combo than them. But with her name being close to Marlena, like in Marlena Dietrich with yeah. the light hair, I had Marlena Dietrich in my mind when reading the book, yeah.
That's so funny. I like that. Yeah, I think there's this thing. I mean, I remember from being a teenage girl not that long ago. Well, kind of that long ago now, 15 years ago. I remember thinking that my friends were beautiful, but I couldn't be. Just because you kind of aren't allowed to feel that way about yourself or to see yourself in any way other than critical. Because, again, the world puts these ideas about how women should look and how teenage girls should look. And are they sexy? And are they this? And Kat, she kind of can't see herself. But she does see her friends in that way. And then I think when Marlena really starts to turn and Marlena really starts to struggle, Kat has these moments where she can kind of peel away her own romantic image of her friend and see that something's wrong. She doesn't actually look that good anymore. Something's going on. But it's always hard to get to the truth behind the myth that you've made, even of the person as you know them.
Men get a pretty tough stick
in
this book.
That. Yeah.
And probably the most positive teenager adult male in the book is her older brother, Jimmy. Mm-hmm. He's 3 years older. Mm-hmm. And why did he turn down his scholarship to Michigan State?
I love his character. He sort of has to be this surrogate. I think he has a great sense of responsibility. And he feels like he has to be the sort of man in the house after his father leaves, basically. I think he feels like I have to take care of my mom and my sister. He feels a sense of responsibility, but I don't see him as a super motivated character. So I don't think he was really super excited to go to college anyways. I think he was sort of looking for a way out. And he never does. He never kind of gets over that choice. He doesn't decide to go back and go do this ambitious thing. And, you know, I think that's totally fine and totally okay. And it's something I wanted to write about, too. I mean, sometimes characters, they have opportunities and they don't take them. What does that mean? Like, why don't we don't see a lot of characters like that in fiction, I think, sometimes. People who were, like, maybe burnouts or burnouts sounds judgmental. I don't mean it that way at all. But I wanted to explore a character who was in many ways very responsible, very smart, very kind, and made a bad choice. Maybe made a bad choice, or maybe he didn't. He just made a choice that a lot of people would be confused about, and that was actually probably the right choice for him.
While Kat feels very depressed and sad at her own situation, mm-hmm. her friends with Marlena, Tidbit, mm-hmm. Greg, Ryder, almost all of them have lost their mothers, mm-hmm. and they think she's so lucky to have her mom close
mm-hmm.
by.
Mm-hmm. It's one of the ways in which she kind of can't see how lucky she is or how much privilege she has. She's like kind of swamped in that teenage angst a little bit, and she doesn't fully understand her own good fortune. But yeah, I also think I wanted to explore too the different kinds of families that there are. And we hear a lot of stories about families without dads, but what about families without moms? What does that look like? How is that different?
Now let's talk about some of the less than inspiring adult mm-hmm. male characters. First, there's Kat's dad, mm-hmm. who has just flaked.
Mm-hmm. Like hardcore
the
flaked.
Way.
Yeah. Yeah, that was something that I thought about a lot. You know, I think not to apply too much of a analysis onto my own characters, because I think in some ways the story has to just be what it is. But I wanted to write about how I was interested in what it means when your dad leaves you when you're at that age. I mean, you're vulnerable anyways, especially Kat's very confused about her place in the world. She's afraid of a lot of things. She doesn't have a strong example. And then something like this happens and she's kind of adrift. So I wanted to talk about that in his absence, or that aspect of his absence. But I also wanted to create in the story the impression of a person who was gone without ever talking about them. I think the fact that he's not there has a lot to do with the choices Kat's making or isn't making, like her behavior with school. And she doesn't even quite know it. And there's really only one scene in the book where he's there with her. But I think his shadow, or the impression that he left behind, is kind of always there for all of the characters, for her mom, for Jimmy, and all the choices that they're making. So, like, how do you write an absent character as a sort of felt presence in a story? That was a question that I was trying to figure out.
Marlena's father, she speaks French with mm-hmm. him. Is that because he's from some old French
trapping
family? French-Canadian trapping
mm-hmm.
family.
Yeah. And also just part of the mystery of Marlena, like, Kat's only known her for a year. I mean, she doesn't know her for very long at all. She makes this huge mark on Kat's life, and that is one of those things where Kat's just kind of constantly finding out that there's so much more to this person than she knows, and really that Marlena isn't something she's invented. She's a real person, but Kat kind of can never get there. And with that, when Kat hears her speaking French, she's like stunned. It's not something she would have invented for Marlena, but it's part of Marlena's universe without Kat.
And then there's an older dealer, mm-hmm. drug dealer named Bolt.
Mm-hmm. That was some of the hardest parts to write because I didn't want to put Marlena in vulnerable situations. But at the same time, I think she's a woman who, a girl, really, she's just a girl, only 17, but who is aware of her power and will use it to get what she wants. But at the same time, she's still a child. So she's also being taken advantage of in really uncomfortable ways. That kind of relationship is something that I wanted to talk about in just as honest of a way as I could, I guess, via a made-up story.
When Kat gets to Silver Lake, she's actually rebranding herself mm-hmm. as Kat instead mm-hmm. of Kath, mm-hmm. how her family and friends had called her back home in Pontiac. And then we have Bolt and we have Tidbit, mm-hmm. who's a friend girl of hers. And I was just thinking about the significance of names and, mm-hmm. and that so many people have kind of nom de guerre mm-hmm. in the story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, nicknames have so much power, I think, actually, especially when you're a teenager. They have so much power. If you have a lame nickname or you like Tidbit is sort of like a cutesy, a little bit patronizing of a nickname, like who gave it to her? It's not something explained in the text, but or in the book rather. But I think that they do have a lot of power. And when you're a teenager, what you call yourself, it's like a declaration. And so when Kat says, I don't want to be this way anymore, I want to be this other way, she kind of can't achieve that. She's still, as we see, like sort of putty in a lot of situations. But that is kind of one step towards taking ownership over her identity and saying, like, I am not going to be this way anymore. I'm going to be this way. Did you ever have any, like, weird nicknames in high school?
In college?
Yeah. See, it's they can be loving, but they can also be, like, what were they?
There are a couple of odd ones. One was motivated by the comic strip Life in Hell by Matt Groening.
I don't know that comic strip. But
the guy that did The Simpsons.
Okay. Oh, cool.
Used to do an alternative Newsweekly comic strip called Life in Hell, and they were talking about nicknames. And so I got a couple of those nicknames. One was Chunk Style.
That's so good.
And another one was Janitor in a Drum.
Oh, my gosh.
And then later on, I was eating too many bananas, according to one of my friends. So I became Simeon Steve, the Prime Primate.
Yeah, that is hilarious. Those are really good. But it's like even in those, you can kind of see like their familiarity, their way of like drawing a connection to a group and saying like, I know you. I see this thing about you. I recognize you. Yeah, I think there's just a lot of power to them. So they're fun to. It's fun to give characters those like alternate different names, I guess.
What are your worst nicknames?
I don't really have that many nicknames. I was just thinking when you were saying all your good nicknames that I don't really have any. Which maybe says something about me.
Did you not have any fun friends that
I, you
just
know,
like to
they
bust?
Called me. They all called me the things you would expect, like Jules, Jay Bunt. I have a couple friends who call me that, but nothing like nothing anywhere as good as like coming from a story or something like that.
Well, Jay Bunt, that's
yeah, Jay Bunt's
bad.
Okay. That's not terrible.
Now, her mom was a big drinker of Franzia Bock Chablis.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Tell us. Why that, and what does that say about her character that she chose that brand and delivery system?
Yeah, well, first of all, boxed wine is cheaper than a lot of other kinds of wine. There's a lot in a box. It keeps for a while. There are a lot of financial considerations the family is dealing with in their new situation. So that's kind of one answer. But also, it's just something that is like just stuck in my own mind from childhood. Like it's something I saw people in Michigan drinking a lot. It's just like a familiar object. So it kind of came back in the novel in that way because I think it just was an image that I'd had.
I actually went online yesterday mm-hmm. and just looked up Franzia wine to see how much it was going for the,
yeah.
the 5-liter box. And a couple of sommeliers had gotten together for some website and reviewed all of the different flavors, all the different
really?
Varietals of there. And they said the Burgundy is the best
oh
among them.
Oh my gosh. You know, it's not terrible. It's really not terrible wine. And boxed wine is becoming a thing now anyways. Like now boxed wine is trendy.
If you can drink two buck chuck, you can drink a boxed wine.
Yeah, definitely.
This is just a weird little point.
Mm-hmm.
But in doing the timelines,
mm-hmm.
It would seem that the timeline of her as an adult in New York in her mid-30s would put her in the mid-2020s.
Mm-hmm. A little bit farther than, yeah.
And, and I just thought that was an interesting concept to set it slightly in the future, but not really address it in any way.
Yeah, so I'm glad you mentioned that. That's something that I thought a lot about. I needed, really, the story to be set circa 2005, 2006, when the girls are teenagers, for a few reasons. I wanted to talk about opioids and the effect that they're having on all sorts of people in the Midwest and in other parts of the country. I wanted to write about those years right before the housing bubble burst and the economy was really rough. I wanted to situate the teenagers at the moment when technology was not at the level that it is now, but was becoming that.
Not quite as pervasive.
Yeah, exactly. When it still felt a little bit like a novelty, but it could change, but teenagers kind of didn't understand the power of it. So all those things were very, very important to the story that I wanted to tell. And what was not important in terms of the narrative present was anything, really, except for Kat's ability to remember. The scenes set in the narrative present are short. They're really a way of situating kind of Kat's vantage point and a way of talking about her drinking. I hope they feel sort of tactile. They feel kind of rooted in those moments, but they're not. It's not about like what her life is like on a day-to-day basis. It's not about how her cell phone looks. It's not about those kinds of things. I really wanted to make the story feel sort of timeless in a way, even with some of those markers in the past that I felt were necessary for the context. So I didn't put any deliberate timestamps in the book. And next year when the paperback comes out, it will be 2018. In 2 years, it will be 2020. Like, hopefully, I mean, who knows if Trump is going to blow us all up. But
I know. I was going to say it's a very optimistic view that we'll still be here.
Right. Well, I should say Trump hadn't been elected. That's like my one thing. I'm like, well, now the world might not exist at all. But I did think about that a lot. And I just felt like those things were the most important part of the story. And I hope that the book has a long life. And in a couple years, that's... you wouldn't even think twice.
I thought it was a nice way to kind of give a very slight, understated homage to speculative fiction that you read when you were a child in a literary fiction setting.
Yeah, thanks. I mean, I'm glad you pointed it out. I always want people to ask me about that because I'm like excited to talk about it because I thought about it so much, but no one ever asks.
Yeah, I'm big on math in books.
Yeah.
I always look for stuff like, you don't state the year. And so I'm going, okay, YouTube was founded in 2006 or so.
Yeah,
and,
right about the beginning of that.
When would they find that? And,
exactly.
To put everything together. I like those little clues to follow in books.
Well, and it was interesting for me to think, too. Like, there are some, I'm glad you said that little nod to the sci-fi. I really do love sci-fi so much. But I was a little playful with it in ways that, like, no one in the world will ever know. But I felt I was being playful, like, with myself while I was writing it. Like, when somebody asks Kat in the narrative present about libraries, Kat works at a library, and they're like, do libraries still exist? Like, that's a joke that could be made now, but it's also definitely a joke that could be made in, like, 5 years. You know what I mean? That's a joke mm-hmm. that will hopefully have a long life. And also, you know, the voicemails quickly becoming obsolete, the fact that it's a voicemail that's triggering the arrival of this person from her past. She thinks about how she never gets voicemails anymore, and, you know, little things like that no one would probably notice. But for me, we're kind of trying to lean into the fact that this takes place a few years from now.
I was wondering, because when we tweeted about you possibly coming on the show, mm-hmm. Alexis Koh, who has been on the show before, mm-hmm. said, yes, you ought to do this.
Yeah.
And she had worked at the New York Public Library, so I didn't know if you had worked there too and had met there.
No, I've never worked at a library. I did talk to some folks who work in libraries, though, to just, you know, again, the scenes in the narrative present are really small and are really about Kat's kind of situating Kat in this sort of safe and dull environment of her adult life. That's also sort of troubled by her struggle with alcohol that's kind of on a precipice. But I did talk to a lot of librarians and a lot of people who work in libraries to say, you know, a few years from now, do you think there'll be people working in programming in libraries doing this kind of like events type work? And yeah, like I had them read the sections and all of that stuff. I only know Alexis a little bit, but so I did sort of like run those things by some of my like library contacts, but I don't work at a library.
You want to hear my favorite library joke?
Yes, definitely.
Our library is situated right next to a McDonald's. Mm. I was walking through the lobby one day, and a guy says to me, he goes, yeah, I'd like a quarter pounder with cheese, fries, and a Coke. I said, sir, this is the library. And he goes, I'm sorry, I want a quarter pounder with cheese.
Oh, my
fries.
God. That's amazing. That's so good.
That's a joke. That's not a real occurrence.
That's so good.
And looking at your bio, you teach at a thing called Catapult, which is, I was trying to wrap my head around everything that Catapult does. Can you give us a little bit of the Catapult story?
Yeah, totally. So I run the creative writing program at Catapult, which is a new independent literary publisher that started about 2 years ago, two and a half now. So we publish literary fiction and nonfiction. 10 to 12 titles a year. What might you have heard of? Margaret the First, we published, came out like last year. Paget Powell's latest collection of short stories, okay. Cries for Help, Various, which is a great book. So we do that. And then in addition to doing that, we have a daily web editorial site that's headed up by Yuka Igarashi, who used to work at Granta and kind of came here to do this job, where we pay for content, fiction and nonfiction mostly. And then kind of the third thing that we do is we have this creative writing program that I started in April 2015, which is really a place for writers to find support, mentorship, feedback, community. And we run probably about 55, 6 to 8 week classes out of our offices a year. And then we do one day masterclasses too on everything from like sort of niche craft stuff, like how to find a voice in your fiction with Mitchell Jackson, for example, to like boot camps on publishing. So I hope it's like a holistic place, kind of like an alternative to an MFA program, cheaper, shorter classes, but still like really amazing instructors. I mean, we've had Mary Gateskill, we've had Tony Tuil Tamudi, we've had Ashley Ford, Chloe Caldwell, Kathleen Alcott, Julia Pierpont. I think writers like to teach for us too, because it's not as huge of a commitment. It's just 6 weeks or 8 weeks. It's something you can do kind of in between gigs. So we wind up working with a lot of awesome writers. I love it. It's a really fun job. It takes up a lot of my time, but I think it's a special organization, kind of looking at writing from every angle, what it means to be part of a literary community and providing that.
Has it left you with enough time to start your next project?
A little bit. I had been working on something for a little while, but I've been a little bit sidetracked lately between the book coming out and then work. So I'm hoping to kind of get back to it after some of this travel winds down. But yeah, set at a boarding school, less teenagers, more teachers.
Well, Julie, I want to thank you so much for stopping by. It's been a great time.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It was such a pleasure. Thank you.
Julie Bunton is the author of Marlena, which is published by Henry Holt & Company. I'm Stephen Ussery, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752. You can find information on upcoming tapings and broadcasts of Book Talk, as well as download podcasts at our blog, WIPLFMBookTalk.blogspot.com.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WIPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.